Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 201. The sounds you're hearing are those of roadworks because South Africa is upgrading, and quickly. The arrival of Governor Sir George Grey in 1854 heralded a new epoch. Previous governors had been Peninsular War veterans. They'd fought against Napoleon. This one was the first who was the child of a veteran of the war and a person who was schooled in liberal humanism. He was also a mid-Victorian, steeped in the consciousness of evolution, principled and simultaneously flaunting truth. A fibber who was in a delirium of post-Renaissance spirituality, combining dialect and salvation. You heard about George Grey's time in New Zealand last episode, and here he was, the new Cape Governor. So without further ado, we're going to dive into episode 201. He was free from prejudice against black and coloured people and all indigenes as such, firmly believing from his own insight into Polynesian cultures, the Maori, that there was nothing to distinguish them in aptitude and intelligence from anyone else in mankind. The same applied to Aborigines and black South Africans, he believed. But Grey wanted indigenous people to wean themselves from what he called barbarism and heathenism. By suppressing tribal laws and customs and incorporating indigenes into the economic system through labour and industry. During his stints in Australia and New Zealand, he had set the Aborigines and Maoris to work building roads, and those who worked the hardest earned the most. At the same time, he ruthlessly suppressed any sort of pushback from the Aborigines and the Maoris, and now he brought this brand of colonialism to South Africa. Dangling the carrot of labour, then applying the stick of punishment, the Cape Colony was his laboratory in the Victorian age of discovery, an intellectual exercise. There was quite a bit in it for him, of course. An ideologue and highly learned, he'd written the New Zealand Articles of Representative Government, an act that led him to being knighted, Sir George. Utopia beckons those who are imbued with internal fire. It's only now and then that history provides a crack into which people with this sort of vision can plunge. A man or a woman appears at a particular point in time, restructuring entire territories and societies by dint of their character, their timing, their epoch. During this time, a powerful figure with a vision for change can restructure an entire land, in this case, before his minders back in England could do anything about it. Correspondence with the Antipodes, New Zealand, Australia, took nearly a year for an exchange of letters to take place. 6 months one way, 6 months return. In the meantime, an industrious social engineer could get very busy indeed. South Africa was closer to the centres of power. The new steam-driven ships could do the return journey in 4 months, but that was more like a financial quarter in modern jargon. A person with initiative could launch quite a few initiatives before the folks back in London put a stop to their initiating. A free hand. These governors would play the autocrat. Govern as they please, then write their own accounts of how well things were going without fear of contradiction. Grey supported the idea of European immigration to the new colonies, particularly in the south. He had come to the conclusion while in Ireland. Emigration of Europeans into Africa would integrate their industry with the locals, and through the locals' labour and their industry, a form of social cohesion and development would transpire. The biggest problem at this point for Grey was not the Amaxhosa or Mazulu or Basutu, nor the Khoi Khoi or the Boers. It was the British Colonial Office. They were in the throes of recession, not expansion, retrenchment, withdrawal. They had handed back the Orange River sovereignty to the Boers. It was about to become the Boer Republic of the Orange Free State, and the British had already recognised the Boer Republics of the Transvaal. More about that process later in next episodes. But you get the picture. Harry Smith's annexion of the Free State was a distant, fleeting ship's smoke on the horizon, to quote Pink Floyd. It was time to focus on territory already obtained. Grey pondered the solution. 5,000 European immigrants should be brought in, he wrote, and occupy British Kaffraria. There was a certain problem, and that was the Amanika Xhosa lived there at a pretty squashed density of 83 people per square mile. To give you an idea of how squashed that was, the Cape Colony population density of 1854 was 1.15 per square mile. The second conundrum was accessing cash to construct all these new schools and public buildings. Gray sent a letter to the Colonial Office outlining his needs. This new plan would require £45,000 a year, of which the skint Cape Colony taxpayer would cough up only a measly £5,000. The £40,000 would come from the British taxpayer. What? What? The Colonial Office would gasp. More expenditure? Gray reminded the technocrats running the political show back in Britain that the Eighth Frontier War had cost a shattering £1 million. What was a piffling £45,000 a year compared to that, he asked, if the investment could ensure stability? He had a good point, because he also recognised that the Amaxhosa had been dealt with atrociously and wrote that the situation on the frontier was simply an armed truce, every day expecting a blow to be struck against us. So, something had to be done that hadn't been done before. You may be very surprised to hear this, but Gray's grand vision was this. Young whites from childhood would be, in his words, mixed up with a civilized coloured race, one from heathenism and barbarism. It must be a shock for many to hear these words from a colonial administrator of 1854. The defining principle, of course, for him was not race, it was education. Those whites and blacks who were educated together could lead together. Quite shocking. In some ways, we wasted another 150 years of toil, snot, trana, and blood getting back to that sort of sentiment. Well, such is life, they say. A policy would create a collaboration of mutual defence against the surging madness beyond the frontiers. This, according to Gray, was the only method to save South Africa from frontier conflict, break down the barriers between the races, and build common ground. Radicals of various colours would, of course, hate this idea right off bat. White and black fundamentalists, ethno-Nazis or whatever colour, not to mention Marxist and revisionist tub-thumpers, will probably have an instant aneurysm hearing this. But wait, there's more. 50 years of British failures, half a century of delusion, and Sir George hit upon what he believed was the secret social source. An influx of European immigrants, coupled with a mammoth infrastructure programme, the Amaxhosa would be put to work building roads, whites and blacks living amongst each other in the bad lands of British Kaffiria would provide examples to each other and others of the region. And the area, he said, would become a populous country filled with a large population, partly European, partly native. The natives won by our exertions to Christianity, trained by us in agriculture and in simple arts, possessing property of their own and a stake in the country. It's that line, possessing property of their own, that kind of leaps out of the page. That was the fundamental difference in the systems launched by other governors. He wanted blacks to possess property of their own. Pretty revolutionary idea. It was the ownership of property that distinguished the settler from the Amaxhosa, the AmaZulu, the Basutu, and so on. For in those Bantu systems, the king or the chief dispensed part-time ownership of the land to supporters in exchange for their labour in terms of becoming a warrior. There was no ownership of land in a property rights sense. The chief merely pointed out a bit of felt, and the newlyweds would set up their huts there, then pay the chief an annual rent in cattle and goods, but there was no direct ownership of the land. The land dwellers were merely janitors on behalf of the king or the chief. The land was transitory. It was not defined in the sense that Gray believed it should be. With regards to infrastructure development, the plans were grand. When the Amaxhosa had built the road, they would be paid, said Gray, and with the money they would buy British products and then attend Anglican communion. He believed in creating a group of people with a common faith and therefore common interest. The colour of skin was secondary. It was the colour of the British pound that mattered, conjoining peoples through their industry and their actions, their labour. Thus, dear listener, was born the first tantalising concepts of a land of peoples enjoined by their common enterprise. Up to this point, governors had perpetuated the us-them sentiment, deploying a kind of crazy-paving colonial crusade of Europeanism versus Africans, rooted in the idea that black people should have their chiefs and their African ways, their indigenous law, and whites and settlers should have their properties and their Roman Dutch law, unequal and segregated. Gray was paternalistic. He was jingoistic. but he opposed segregation. In Natal, missionary Theophilus Shepstone was not so sure about this. He wanted AmaZulu law to be respected in what he thought of as reserves. The chiefs could be converted to Christianity, but the Zulus' land could be protected by segregation from the settlers. Shepstone wasn't the only one who raised an eyebrow upon hearing about Grey's momentous plan. South African commercial advertiser editor John Fairburn was sceptical, believing that Grey was sketching a picture of the colony with its smiles and glowing future that was actually drawing a portrait, really, of his own mind. Ready to undertake any good work without encumbering his faculties or troubling his nerves with difficulties. Excuse the bad Scots accent again. Thus said, Grey embarked on road building. Cheap Xhosa and other indigenous labour was going to make it possible to build a network through the Cape. The grand vision, though, had a very dark side. It was a kind of chain gang mentality. If these people didn't want to become labourers, they would be forced, because, said Grey, God is great. And behind this enterprise, and through enterprise, Xhosa would develop, and once developed, they would not fight the British. Labourer pay would be sixpence per day, or £15 a year, but the cost of rations would mean they earned probably less. Sixpence, or 6 cents per day, which in 1854 was equivalent to $2.55, when rands, around 46 rands a day, at least in today's value. But real earning was about half of that because of rations and other costs. Grey's plan was hamstrung by a few economic realities. The cost of establishing a 200-acre farm in 1854 was around £600. If that also worked as a labourer, then wanted to buy his own farm, a plough was worth a year's salary. If the worker wanted to buy tools, like spades, an axe and a pickaxe, these three would cost around £3. Houses cost £18 to build. What Grey's plan would actually do, according to De Kivit, the historian, is to turn AmaXhosa from barbarism to pauperism. Xhosas would have to buy clothes to work in. These were mandatory for colonial employment. No more semi-naked clay-ornamented bodies allowed. While the plan for the Xhosa labourers matured, watching all of this were the Amamfengu, the people who'd migrated into the Eastern Cape as refugees during the last 3 decades of tumult. They were now prospering. Many owned wagons and ploughs, and they were running European-style farms. Grey was keeping a close eye on the Amamfengu, living proof of his plan because they were also an example of what happens when men and women receive an education. Independent spirit grows. And then the new governor was rather concerned because he noticed that young Amamfengu men had become haughty and insolent, a source of danger rather than strength to us. The Amamfengu men were giving voice to their spirit of struggle against their own travails, colonialism, and giving notice to the Victorian English there would be no one's lackeys. Thus, the contradiction evident in the ideology that black people should always know their place, even when educated. Not get too uppity, you know. Grahamstonians were fully aware of this haughtiness, and editorials were written about how the Amamfengu would join forces with AmaXhosa in some future war. The black-white thing. With all of this as a backdrop, let us consider Grey's first year. And what a year it was. He had immediate achievements whose impact on South African society was to be enduring. The energy with which he built schools for black people, industrial training centres, hospitals, was incredible. The missionaries were gobsmacked, particularly those at Lovedale, run by the Glasgow Missionary Society. Industrial training for Xhosa boys was launched, where carpentry, masonry, blacksmithing, wagon making and agriculture could be learned and became the foundation of all black education in South Africa. Practically the entire struggle leadership that emerged later in the 19th and 20th centuries owe their education to these industrial schools. For their successor schools were places like Fort Hare University, where Nelson Mandela was to learn law. Perhaps the most visible example of Sir George Grey's immense plan was Grey's Hospital in King Williamstown. This venerable institution had a major impact on the average person in the street, the average Xhosa-speaking person. Prior to this construction, Xhosa were treated in back rooms and other parts of clinics, all by traditional methods. At Grey's Hospital, cataracts were removed. Aged Xhosa women wrote letters to Queen Victoria with things like, I was 16 years blind, Mother, O Queen, but now I see perfectly. I see everything. I see the stars, the moon, and the sun. Unfortunately, Gray began to compose letters that rode on the back of this sort of sentiment. Letters that were, in a word, baloney, bunkum, devious.
The state of the country is so critical, warned Sir George in a letter to the Colonial Office, that its whole future depends on the promptitude with which measures are now taken to avert the evils which threaten it.
Gives for aye money, is basically what he was saying. Money or we get boxing.
Back home, the British government was in no state to entertain Grey's demanding dosh. The Crimean War had gone very badly indeed. The war was also one of the first to be documented extensively in written reports and in photographs. And in fact, Reuters news agency was launched on the back of this war. The Crimea quickly became a symbol of logistical, medical, and tactical failure and of mismanagement. The reaction in Britain led to a demand for the professionalization of medicine, most famously achieved by Florence Nightingale, who gained worldwide attention for pioneering modern nursing while she treated the wounded. It's important to connect the dots here. The Crimean War was to have an even more profound impact on South Africa in a couple of years, in 1857, when German veterans of that war were shipped into the Eastern Cape. Well, in 1854, the political scene in England was one of chaos. Party lines were in disarray, and the post of Secretary of State for the Colonies saw a new man every few months. The lack of continuity occurred just as Sir George Grey settled into office. While his plea for money went largely unheard, this chaos allowed Sir George to fiddle about, gave him even freer rein than any other Cape governor up to that point. To a degree, there was a technocrat called the Permanent Under-Secretary at the Colonial Office who did keep a close eye on Grey. But with the secretary's chair changing every time the political music stopped, there wasn't much the Permanent Under-Secretary could do. By July 1855, Sir George Grey would have served under five different secretaries of state for the colonies, all in one year. Grey turned his attention to Amaxhosa traditions and vowed to end barbarous customs, including the putting to death of persons accused of witchcraft. When Amanhlambe Chief Mhala's favourite ox had died suddenly, he had ordered the execution of half a dozen men and women. Grey now appointed British magistrates to all principal chiefs, and these chiefs were going to become dependents on government salaries. They were going to receive stipends, and these salaries were replacing their own systems of fines and punishments, an ancient custom that kept the Xhosa wheels of justice oiled in their own particular way. Xhosa wheels of justice, unfortunately, included smelling out witches. So Grey thought by replacing this judicial system with a British system, witchcraft killings would be expunged. Opposing him were not just the chiefs, who initially balked at his proposal, but his own chief commissioner of British Kaffraria, Lieutenant Colonel John McLean. Any white magistrate sent to oversee Xhosa law would be seen as proof that their chief's power was being usurped. An entire war had been fought over this, the most expensive so far, the Eighth Frontier War, and here was Grey hiking tensions once more. McLean wrote a formal letter to Grey in which he said that the Xhosa cling tenaciously to his old customs and habits, is proud of his race, which he considers pure blood and superior to others, is therefore inherently national, is suspicious, and holds aloof from others. The others, Sir George Cathcart, had promised the chiefs that this wouldn't happen. Now, this latest Sir George flipped the bird. Amanxhosa Commissioner George Brownlee agreed it was a bad idea. Such a change would take place in time, said Brownlee, but this was not the time. Grey ignored these two experienced men's objections. As you're going to hear, his plan would be instituted, and most chiefs would agree to this new system of justice. But it was going to be under duress because the timing would coincide with the Xhosa cattle killings. Time for a quick whip around what was happening in the rest of southern Africa in 1854. Basutu King Moshoeshoe had been gathering weapons and materiel for 2 decades, and by the mid-1850s, his people had built up their flocks of sheep and goats and herds of cattle. They had cultivated much of the fertile land on both sides of the Caledon River, and by now Lesotho was the granary of the southern Harveld. While livestock and production of grain could vary sharply based on the weather, season to season, overall the trend was upwards. Population density was lower than in parts of the Eastern Cape and Zululand, so the Basotho mixed farming system was stable. Soil was not exhausted, and the quality of agriculture was improving because of the importation of metal hoes and ploughs as well as wagons. Customary crops like millet were now growing alongside maize and wheat and potatoes, which had made it all the way to Lesotho from their origin in the Andes of South America. Most settlers who lived in the southern Highveld, the Boers, were now dependent on Moshoeshoe's people for most of their grain supplies. The trekkers could rear the best cattle, but they weren't the best farmers, at least at this stage of South African history. The volume of trade into the interior had risen substantially, and like in other parts of Africa, trade followed the cross, the missionaries. During the mid-1850s, several traders had set up permanent shop, literally erecting buildings in Besheba, Mokwatleng, Thabo Bosiu, and Moria. French missionary Abusse wrote in 1854 how "this trade is carried on by the farmers of the Orange Free State, but in addition, two speculators, one Dutch, the other English, have settled in the place with their families and trade there in wheat, millet, cattle, and horses." Yes, a vague attempt at a French accent. These speculators weren't alone. There was also a Boer man who was a wheelwright and blacksmith and a brickmaker and a tailor who lived alongside Moshoeshoe. There was no money or very little in circulation in Lesotho in the mid-1850s. Trade was exchange, bartering. Moshoeshoe was the wealthiest man in the country. He owned the largest collection of European goods, household utensils, knives, forks, spoons, and groceries like tea, coffee, clothing, agricultural implements, wagons, firearms and ammunition, saddles, horses. He had hired white stonemasons to construct houses for him on Thabo Bosiu, although he still preferred to live in his traditional dwelling. Most of his vast herds were stored or pastured away from Thabo Bosiu, lent or mafisa to men in cattle posts far away. Women possessed very little. They cultivated the lands but didn't control their produce. This was a classic patriarchal society. The Basotho king could not monopolize trade, but ever since he'd experienced the devastating effects of firearms and horses when raided by the Coloureds, the Bastards, the Karana, the Griqua, the Boers, he'd been acquiring muskets and horses. Basotho, who worked for white farmers in the Cape Colony, or Trans-Oranje, had purchased these two essential items, while plunder also accounted for some of the acquiring. The horses were mainly those of Cape Colonial stock, and these originated mainly from the Orient, the Middle East, with an infusion of English thoroughbreds. The horses flourished in Lesotho, where there was almost no horse sickness, and the hardy Lesotho pony could be seen everywhere by the mid-1850s. The Sand River Convention had banned the sale of guns to Africans, but that didn't stop Boer and English traders, who made a handsome profit from bartering arms and ammunition to Africans. For the moment, however, the Free State's troubles came from within rather than from without. Bloemfontein, at this point, as well as Smithfield, had more English residents than Boers. They were as English as Grahamstown, but they were tiny in comparison. Fewer than 200 buildings, one story, all told, and farms were widely scattered here. 8 million acres of land still owned by the Crown, unsold. Of the rest, 13 million acres were reserves for blacks, and 11 million owned by landlords, absentee landlords mainly. 200 of these absentee farms lay in a line between Winburg and Harrismith, only broken by three farmers who lived there, and it would take their herds into Natal for winter pasture. The line between the Basotho, the Amantembu, the Boer was uncertain. It was a dotted line. Lions and wild game lived on these absentee farms. They were untamed. The land that would become known as South Africa was dominated by pastoral scenes. The trekkers in the north came to the south for gunpowder and tobacco, Basotho grain. It is to these northern Boer republics, though, we're going to ride next episode. There's much to say about the republics of Potchefstroom, Windhoek, Lydenburg, Urgstad, and Schoemansdal. The latter was the base for ivory traffic in the north. Schoemansdal was the largest of all of these, richer and pretty contemptuous of its main rival, Potchefstroom. Martinus Pretorius and Piet Potgieter had succeeded their famous fathers, who'd fought the Amandebele and AmaZulu and then each other. The Volksraads of these republics were seeking a solution to the incessant internal squabbling. Piet Potgieter wouldn't last long, dying during a commando hunting Chief Makapane in September 1854. I'll come back to that tale next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate its visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm going to load an update about the series. You can email me from there. Until next, tot ziens.